Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
From AccuWeather, this is Everything Under the Sun. Real news and real stories covering topics from the worlds of science, sports, and space. It's all the information you need to weatherproof your life. And now here's the host of Everything Under the Sun, AccuWeather meteorologist Dean DeVore.
And friends, welcome in. This is episode 7 here in the year of 2023 of Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com. I know if you are like me, the images and the death toll numbers have been staggering and emotional to see for those folks that have been dealing with the devastation from the earthquakes in Turkey and Syria. And they prompted a lot of questions from my friends who know, yes, I'm a meteorologist, but might have some thoughts about earthquakes. And so I wanted to get some of the latest information from an earthquake expert, and we have one who has been studying this since he got shaken out of bed in California back when he was a youngster. He will talk to us about that area of the world and what's to come and where else in the world we could see more earthquakes. And is there any relationship between earthquakes and the weather? And we'll also be visiting with our friend Evan Myers, our monthly visit, talking about weather and history, blizzards. Two different kinds are going to be in the subject matter in our second segment. Sit back and relax, friends. It's time to talk about everything under the sun from AccuWeather.com. The numbers are devastating. The images are shocking. 50,000 souls lost so far, with that number climbing in Turkey and Syria. And there's potential for more, as we're going to hear from an expert on earthquakes who I wanted to bring in because, look, the devastating images and those numbers in Turkey and Syria and also some other earthquakes that have popped up in the United States here in the last couple of weeks have gotten a lot of people to top of the mind awareness about earthquakes, where we are in terms of forecasting or predicting, how we could see effects, what parts of the world and in even the United States are going to be more susceptible to that. And we found this gentleman who I think you're going to enjoy. I know I really enjoyed talking to him and learning a lot. His name is Dr. Jeffrey Park. He's at Yale University. And since he got shaken out of bed by the 1971 Sylmar, California earthquake, he's dedicated his life to earthquake research and presentation and letting people know what we know about them. And he joins us here on Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com. Dr. Park, it is great to have you here on Everything Under the Sun. You know, as a meteorologist, we are the ad hoc scientific experts on everything in the newsroom sometimes. Unfortunately, I think I did study plate tectonics and movement and that kind of stuff, but earthquakes, obviously, with the recent news, Turkey and Syria, and even some earthquakes that have happened in the United States, close to AccuWeather headquarters. And there was a earthquake a couple of weeks ago, I think plus four, a little over four on the Richter scale up around Buffalo. And so I'm getting a lot of questions and a lot of interest in earthquakes and seismology. Obviously, weather and this are two very different things. There are some folks that have asked me if there's a correlation between weather and seismic activity. I guess the one thing, you know, obviously, when we're looking at top of mind awareness and what's happened in Turkey and Syria, some people are concerned that we're seeing an increase in seismic activity versus maybe the last 5 or 10 years. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that aspect of it. Is it more? Is it less? I'm sure in the last couple of weeks, your phone has gotten a little bit busier, right? With all this earthquake, right?
Yes, yes. I've had chances to speak to with journalists as far away as Qatar.
Wow. Yeah. So there's interest there. So just the basic premise, are we more active seismically or are we less active or is it about the same as you look over averages here over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, if you're talking globally, the earthquake activity is still, it's more or less the same. Earthquakes are a sudden catastrophic events, but they tend to occur kind of with a probability that is pretty steady worldwide. we can be pretty sure that there'll be maybe one, maybe sometimes two, what we call great earthquakes, magnitude 8 or above, that would occur every year, like one usually is typical average. And then you go down to, you know, magnitude 7 earthquakes, 7 point something in the Richter scale, maybe about once every month worldwide. Most of these earthquakes are occurring in places that are remote to the world news media. There's usually people, but they're not structures that would cause a great deal of damage. I mean, one of the most active places on the planet is Tonga, Fiji, the islands, where there can be damage from earthquakes, but usually the locals have adapted to them and the structures to be, you know. But in areas like Turkey, for instance, you can have entire generation of construction that occurs between earthquakes. In fact, more than that, the area that has been rupturing in the month of February 2023 was relatively quiet through much of the 20th century. However, seismologists recognize that region of Turkey as a major fault zone that's associated with a major plate boundary, the boundary between the Arabian plate and the Anatolian plate, and that they are moving with respect to each other sideways. The earthquakes that occurred are consistent with this, but, you know, that motion is often measurable by global positioning systems, geodetic measurements on the order of millimeters per year.
Right.
And that can be seen, but that movement is occurring elastically as the two plates are moving past each other.
Yep.
And that elastic energy builds up over time, and it could be a decade, it could be a century, it could be two centuries. And then it will become released, and then you'll see major earthquake and then major ground motion.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, when we have changes in the weather, and in some ways it's the same thing. It's like if you think of the tectonic plates as air masses, right? And you've got movement between in weather, the two air masses, that happens rapidly, right? In the grand scheme of things, right? And so the volatility of those rapid air mass changes are what produces the big storm events. If you kind of take that analogy to earthquakes, to me, that movement between the tectonic plates, in this case, the, you know, thinking about the air masses, is small and it's not linear sometimes, you're right. And then it's just those little movements. And after a certain time, that energy builds up and has to be released because that's the way it works, right? And so is that a good analogy?
It is a good analogy. The analogy is a little bit like we know that hurricanes will occur when you get enough warmth into the tropical ocean, and that will that's the fuel for it. In this case, it's the motions of the plates that are being driven basically globally. It's the whole convection of the entire planet, of the plates moving around. And normally it's moving very slowly, but wherever you're near the surface, the rocks resist this over time. And eventually you build up enough elastic strain that they will fail. And then there's motion on a fault.
And then that's the severe catastrophic motion that we can see. And
yes,
it was interesting. You talked about the region that has been just suffering now, Turkey and Syria. As you said, it was identified. This is an area they've had problems. The building code, there was building rules and codes and regulations put in, but it appears that maybe some of the extensiveness of this damage may be due to those codes and laws and maybe not being followed the way they should in those areas after being a generation or two without a major earthquake.
I mean, that certainly is one of the possibilities. It's often common that occurs. Also, people's memories are short, and especially in regions that have not had a major earthquakes in a generation or more, that enforcement can become lax. For instance, you know, much of the damage that still occurs in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles area, after some of their moderate earthquakes, would occur primarily among buildings that were built before the earthquake codes of 1933. And so there's a lot of old structures in Turkey, and also structures that are not they're simple apartment buildings that may not have had the same scrutiny, or they may have been built a long time before the codes were put into place. But this is actually a problem. It's something that the government needs to pay attention to, because sometimes these buildings, these structures need to be looked at, reinforced, sometimes torn down and rebuilt. And the plate boundary is there. It will occur. There will be earthquakes there in the future. The presence of these earthquakes this month in February is loading neighboring faults. It's actually increasing the stress on faults around it. There are studies that have shown, oddly enough, some of these studies were in northern Turkey 20 years ago, that just changing the stresses along a fault zone by a few bars, you know, one bar is one atmosphere of pressure.
Right.
But if you change it by a couple of bars, you will help induce earthquakes there. It will increase the probability of the next earthquake. It will not necessarily occur tomorrow. It could occur 5 years on. It could occur a decade on. But gives you some time to prepare.
But you've increased it. Nonetheless, it's just at this point, we're not capable scientifically of being able to predict with any certainty when that accelerated situation will occur. So that's the challenge of all of this.
Let me give a bit of seismology terminology. Is that seismologists make a distinction between earthquake prediction and earthquake forecasting.
Okay.
Earthquake prediction is being able to tell within weeks, hours, imminence of an earthquake. And that very, very difficult, except in special cases, like, you know, that there will be aftershocks after a large earthquake. So that's something where you can make a prediction.
Sure.
But forecasting is something where you're thinking 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And we think we have we understand the physical principles behind that. And can make reasonable predictions. But then all of those forecasts, I'm going to use the word forecast properly here, are probabilistic. It means that you're at higher risk, that if you're going to build a structure that you plan to last for 25 years, you'd better expect it to have an earthquake if we've raised the forecast there. It will have to withstand shaking of a certain amount.
Are there places, as we turn maybe our attention to this country, and just let me remind everybody, and this is amazing stuff, I'm learning everything by the second here. We're talking to Dr. Jeffrey Park. He is at Yale University. Well, he grew up in Orange County. So you got shaken out of bed one time, and that's how you got into earthquakes? Is that what happened?
Yes. In fact, I experienced the 1971 Sylmar earthquake.
Sylmar, yeah.
Wow. That shook up the LA basin. And within a year, I had seen the NOVA program on the invention of plate tectonics, and I was hooked. I ended up studying that in college and then
at Princeton for your bachelor's degree. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed this. You argued against the theory that large earthquakes could cause observable changes in the Earth rotation's axis.
Yes.
You were somebody that was against the norm in that kind of thinking early on. Is that true?
Well, it was a small controversy in the early 1980s and late 1970s in which I was involved in. But when you did the calculations properly, you could tell that very large earthquakes can actually move enough material around to change some of the kind of like what you would call the moment of inertia of Earth.
Like in your clothes dryer when part of it gets all jumped up into one part?
Exactly.
And it's starting to give out that bad noise. And so
you've
got the movement, the rotation isn't as nice. And
that's a good analogy in that you would move enough mass around that Earth rotation would go off kilter a little bit, as though you had like flicked a spinning axis, a spinning top. It turns out actually that meteorology has a bigger effect than earthquakes do, because there's a lot more mass moving around when you're moving water.
Let's talk about the United States.
Yes.
Obviously, Southern California has the cred for being the earthquake capital of the United States for generations. Been seeing more in the middle of the country. Oklahoma's been seeing a lot recently.
Yeah, yes.
And how are we in the United States about potential earthquakes going over the next several years, decades?
The western coast of the United States, the west, the West Coast is an area of very active earthquake activity, of different types of earthquakes, depending on the geology and the local plate boundaries. The famous San Andreas Fault has a strike slip motion in which the two sides of the fault move sideways. But if you go up to Seattle, you'll have a rather large and somewhat dangerous, what's called a subduction zone, where part of the ocean floor is actually diving underneath the coastline.
Right.
And that's a region that we know has sustained an earthquake that's as large as the earthquake that devastated Sumatra in 2004. We know this because the tsunami that was caused by an earthquake in the year 1700 was measured in Japan.
In the 1700s, an earthquake in northwestern United States in the Seattle, Washington area was so strong that it produced a tsunami that was recorded in Japan, is what you're just telling me.
Yes. And it's mainly because the Japanese have been measuring the tides and tsunami waves for a lot longer than that. So they monitored that. So there was a mysterious pulse that was in their data set that a Japanese seismologist dug up and related it to a sort of Native American reports of a large shaking that occurred in the Pacific Northwest in the early 1700s. Now, of course, the Native Americans didn't have a calendar, but the Japanese did. So it's not the 1700s. We know the year, we know the day.
Interesting. So that's an area that I think as a seismologist, you're saying, well, we may be overdue there.
I'd say that's a concern, actually, the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. What about eastern parts of the country where, you know, like I said, just a couple of weeks ago, Buffalo made news because they had a 4.3, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. The eastern U.S. has, and Canada has some really interesting causality, the geologic and geophysical factors that are involved in their seismic activity. There's maybe 1/10 to maybe 1/100 of the seismic activity in the eastern U.S. as there is along the major plate boundaries of the western U.S. Here on the East Coast, we're not close to a plate boundary. The nearest plate boundary is actually in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow.
But we live on a coastline that only 12,000 years ago was carrying a glacier full of ice that was a kilometer high. And it had pushed down the land by a substantial amount. I mean, a kilometer of ice would push the land down by some fraction of the kilometer.
Right, at least a half a kilometer, you would think. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And so since the glaciers have retreated, that load has been removed and the coastline has been rising. That tends to cause shear stresses right at where the old edge of the ice sheet had been. So there are faults that are not very active, but they exist as zones of weakness that can relieve some of the stresses that are being built up as the center of North America rebounds.
Any other parts of the world that we should be thinking about here in the future or looking at that you think are potential hotspots going over the next several years?
I'd say Turkey has got some concerns on that zone.
About maybe half, not be done yet, right?
It's not done yet. In fact, I'm actually looking at the map as I speak to you, is that the magnitude 7.8, magnitude 7.5 occurred on faults that were fairly close together. One kind of must have triggered the other when it went off. More recently, about 2 weeks later, there's a magnitude 6.3 earthquake that occurred on an extension of that fault zone to the south towards, I believe it was Antioch. And so that's probably a portion of a fault zone that had been stressed by the main earthquake, but had not broken yet. And it may have. And then if you go farther inland, up towards the source of the Euphrates River, this East Anatolian fault zone is there still ripe for rupturing to make up about the same amount of motion as was released in the earthquakes earlier this month.
As we wrap up here, I started saying, you know, no proof or no thing in terms of whether the weather influences seismic activity or not. We're just starting to unwrap the relationships between seismic activity, volcanic activity, the release of that heat that's in the middle of the world, in the middle of the earth, up to the surface. So I think those are things that we haven't even gotten our heads wrapped around scientifically when we're looking at trying to make weather forecasts and all the kinds of other things. And so, you know, hopefully all these things continue to come together in terms of relationships. Is that something that you've thought about too?
Some of the stresses that are involved in weather, they're much smaller than the stresses involved in that could of loading by nearby earthquakes.
Right.
But there have been some studies that have found kind of weak correlations, say, between tidal stresses and earthquake activity. Usually it's lower level earthquake activity, small earthquakes that are slightly more numerous when the tidal stresses are greater and slightly less numerous when tidal stresses are lower. So it's unlikely that weather by itself or weather systems are going to be an important trigger for large earthquakes, but they're not completely out of the picture.
Do we feel that at some point we'll start understanding how what's going on seismically, earthquake-wise, may affect the weather and the atmosphere on the top side?
So going the opposite direction.
Opposite direction, right. Does the seismic and the volcano actually being affected on our climate change situation, global warming, all those kinds of things?
So if we go back, we want to find geological analogs in Earth history for what we're doing now to the atmosphere with adding carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Right.
This has happened in Earth's past many times. And it usually is that one of the greatest sources for carbon dioxide in the atmosphere on short timescales are massive volcanic eruptions.
Mm.
Volcanoes emit carbon dioxide. And so the carbon dioxide then can help trigger greenhouse warming the same way that our burning fossil fuels is doing.
Yeah.
There are episodes in Earth history, and these are actually episodes that mark the boundaries between different layers of the geologic timescale.
Wow.
Those happen because a lot of species die out and others speciate and replace them. Many of these, the biggest turnovers of species occur when there are these sort of massive worldwide volcanic events that among the things, the effects that they have is that they add a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Funny how scientists and historians have done a lot of work and sometimes in the moment we forget all that stuff, right? And it's nice to be reminded that this stuff has happened before. Not to say that we can't help the outcome here with being responsible in some ways, but I think this is certainly something I think in the end people are going to start taking a look at, that relationship. Dr. Park, anything else you wanted to add as we wrap up?
My only other comment about that is that when volcanoes push carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, eventually has to come out. But actually, a lot of that comes out when you weather rock at the surface. You turn like granites into clays and things. This is a process that is occurring all the time, but can be accelerated if you increase the surface area that's of virgin rock that's exposed. And that's one of the strategies that's being put forward as a way to address global warming.
Is to actually create more
rock surface to actually absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
We will leave it at that. And I think there's another podcast interview with you and other people, my friend, in those regards. But Dr. Park, thank you so much. This was fascinating. I hope you enjoyed the questions.
Oh, yeah.
I hope we asked good questions, and we'll certainly, I think a lot of people will be informed because of this. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's fun to talk.
Thanks again to Dr. Park. We look forward to having him on again. I think as you heard there towards the end of the interview, there are certainly more on things to pack between earthquakes and weather and climate that we could talk about with Dr. Park in the near future. And we'll keep an eye on the earthquake situation here on Everything Under the Sun going forward. We have an eye on history here every month. We visit with our friend Evan Myers to talk about weather and history, and we've got a blizzard of information coming up. This is Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Whether you're at home getting ready for work, packing the kids' lunch, or commuting, listen to AccuWeather Daily. Subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, and you'll get the top trending weather story of the day every day.
Welcome back to Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com. Once a month, we sit down with our friend and colleague, Evan Myers, who is our font of knowledge in terms of weather and history. And here in March, it's very common to get volatile, huge storms that can create blizzard conditions. But did you know there was a time when the word blizzard didn't even have anything to do with the weather? And there's also another kind of blizzard that has nothing to do with snow. Evan Myers joins us now on Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com. You know, we're looking at March, and it's hard to believe. I mean, the Eastern Seaboard has been really stormless in a lot of ways. Just getting, as this podcast drops, coming off of a pretty significant situation from near New York City up through Boston and probably one of their most significant storms. But this is the time of year, Evan, where we see ramped up blizzards in the Northeast, and it's because this is the time of year we're starting to see those air masses try to move. The cold air wants to hold on sometimes in the north, and then the warm air, well, it's been really surging northward all winter. We've had incursions of milder than normal air, and so when you have those kinds of differences, it can really spin up big storms, and we saw that back in 1888. The blizzard of 88. Let's talk about that blizzard that really defined one of the earliest weather stories for blizzards in the North Atlantic and the Mid-Atlantic states.
Well, that's right. You know, you hear the blizzard of 88, you think, is that 1988? No, 1888. Well, and you're right. You know, cold air is heavier than warm air.
Yeah, we saw that last week.
Cold air's got to move. Warm air can't push cold air out of the way. The opposite occurs. Cold air pushes warmer out of the way. So if cold air doesn't retreat, where's the warm air go? It can't go into the ground. It's forced to ride up and over the cold air, and you get that kind of lift and spinning motion in the atmosphere, and you can crank up some big storms. And, you know, it's interesting. Prior to the blizzard of March 11th, 1888, that affected New York City the most but really affected all the Northeast, prior to that, in the decades before that, from prior to the Civil War, there hadn't been a really huge snowstorm in the Northeast, and there hadn't been a huge snowstorm in New York City, and New York City had grown exponentially far as its population is concerned.
You know, you look back at the numbers there, Evan, you're right. Around 1850, there was only about 850,000, and by 1880, it had ballooned up to 2 million people. So that's explosive growth in those 30 years.
Well, absolutely, and we had all that growth, no big snowstorms, but all that was about to change in March of 1888. And we can reconstruct the weather maps. And the scenario as you laid it out, their cold air actually moved in as a huge storm with moisture-laden air came moving up the eastern seaboard, and it just spun up right over New York City, a bomb cyclone, really, as we talk about today. And the interesting thing is, there's a couple of new things that came into existence. First of all, the term blizzard was a new thing. It wasn't used in conjunction with snowstorms until the 1870s.
Okay.
A newspaper in Iowa termed a big snowstorm there a blizzard. Previously, it had been used to talk about cannon fire.
Oh.
So explosive, you know, explosive development, bomb cyclone.
See, it's kind of interesting. I love etymology like that. So the word blizzard didn't really come from the weather. It came from warfare.
It came from the boom of cannons. And so Iowa used that. Iowa newspaper used that. And so by the 1880s, though, it had been around for about 10 years, and it was certainly in much more common use at that point. The other interesting thing is, Dean, is that snowplows, the first snowplow that was used in the United States was in Milwaukee in 1862, but snowplows didn't really come into existence in most of the major cities until the turn of the century, until about 1900.
Wow.
So you have cities exploding in population,
right?
All kinds of new transportation, elevated systems in New York City, no subways.
Right.
There was no subway in New York City built until 1904.
Wow.
So it was all elevated trains, and they came into vogue right after the end of the Civil War. So you had elevated tracks all over the place in New York as the population continued to explode. And then you mix that in with this giant snowstorm that hit, very cold weather, and there was no way to clean it up. The way they cleaned up the streets prior to the advent of snow plows was they used snow rollers. They would roll the snow, try to pat it down.
Make it flat.
Just made everything icy.
Icy, right.
And prior to 1890s, it was the responsibility in New York City of the police department to clean
now
the streets.
Now it's sanitation.
It is.
Right?
Right after the blizzard of 88 and the horrible things that happened, all the people that died and all the people that got stuck and so on, they transferred that from the police department. They created really a streets department that did the cleaning. But it's interesting. The storm was slow to organize. About 10 inches of snow in Philadelphia, but then it turned rapidly into that bomb cyclone. And 20 inches of snow in New York City, 45 inches of snow in Albany, New York, New Haven, Connecticut.
And with winds that I'm seeing
85 miles an hour.
So that would be like probably producing 10-foot drifts in places?
Well, so tens of thousands of people got stuck. Well, maybe not. It was about 15,000 people, I think, that was estimated got stuck on the elevated trains because the drifts got all the way up to the elevated trains, and there was no way of getting folks off those trains. There was no way of clearing the streets. It was just a mess. 400 people died in the blizzard of 88.
Yeah, and you think about it, at that time, about one in every four Americans lived in that corridor from New York City to Boston. I mean, that certainly important that corridor is now and how many people live on that. And so when we have a storm that we see hitting that area, and honestly, this scenario is something that concerns me about later on this month into early April, where we could see some kind of development up along the coastal areas and this kind of bomb cyclone.
It's kind of interesting, Dean, even though this occurred more than 130 years ago, it is still the benchmark to which all other storms are measured. It's really interesting.
Let's talk about a blizzard of another type. They call this the Black Blizzard, but this has nothing to do with snow. This is about the Dust Bowl back in the 1930s.
It very much is, and it was called a Black Blizzard because it turned the sky black. Huge dust clouds. Really, it wasn't dust. When I clean my house at home, that's dust.
That is.
This
dust.
Is not dust.
When you when you or Lynn clean, I don't see you up there with
my job. Well, I don't think you've been to my house when I was cleaning.
Right.
So we'll just stop it there.
Okay.
But it's my job to do the vacuuming, and we do have animals at home, and
yes,
so the amount of hair that those cats and dogs, it's interesting. But this was not dust. What this was topsoil. This was dirt, and it was raised into huge billowing clouds.
It was so dry that you had gone down and just basically made the layer of, 2-3 inches of just pulverized dust that was blown around.
It went even deeper than that, and it's kind of interesting. It's a combination of the weather and the fact that it was unbelievably dry and was in the midst of a horrible drought, but also farming techniques. Mm. The fact is the Great Plains at one point was called the Great American Desert because it really didn't get much rain, but there was a lot of high grass that had deep roots that grew there and held the soil in place. There was about a 20-year period in which things became more moist around the 1900 to the 1920s, and so farmers were encouraged to plant more crops. So what did they do? They plowed under all that high grass that was holding the dirt in place, and they planted smaller roots, and then it reverted back to the dry conditions. It was before the great irrigation that you see with all those big things that if you'd ever driven out west on the plains, those giant irrigation things that are almost like a home sprinkler, except they cover a much greater area.
Five parking lots.
They tap into the subterranean aquifers that are out there, but they didn't do that then. And so what happened was it dried up. There was nothing to hold the dirt in place. And then as it got drier and drier, and as you mentioned, the dryness got deeper and deeper, it was just ripe for big storms to just pull up the dust, pull up the dirt, and blow it all over the place.
Amarillo, Texas, 6 feet
deep. Of
that,
yes.
Yeah,
March 15th,
wow.
1935, right in the midst of this, of the Dust Bowl, just choking billows of dust were named. They were named black blizzards because it turned day into night, and it just was black outside. One of the worst of these black blizzards struck Amarillo, as you mentioned. Six people died, but hundreds or thousands of livestock starved or suffocated. And as you said, 6 feet. So this is not 6 feet of snow. This is 6 feet of dust that piled up.
Dust and dirt.
All over
dirt,
the place.
Right? Just like topsoil.
It was everywhere. And, you know, this caused the Great Migration. This is what caused the Okies to head to California. This is the Grapes of Wrath. Read that great novel by John Steinbeck.
Yep.
Woody Guthrie sang about all this kind of stuff. It was a terrible time. We were middle of the Great Depression. People were starving, and the compounded was the weather and the drought, and on top of that were these huge storms that occurred. Some of this dust and some of these black blizzards blew as far east as Washington, D.C. One event occurred in which in Boston it turned the sky dark during the middle of the day from dust from Kansas and Oklahoma. Amazing.
Friends, that'll wrap up Episode 7 of Everything Under the Sun here in 2023. We hope you join us again next week where we take that place where the weather meets your life and talk about it, whether it's sports, golf, outdoor activities, gardening, astronomy, everything where the weather can impact the things that you do. We'll talk about it here on Everything Under the Sun. For our executive producers, Ken Prell and Andrew Robb, and our hundreds of team members who work hard every day, 24/7, to produce the information that can help you weatherproof your life, whether it's on our AccuWeather apps, whether it's on Android or the Apple platform, whether it's on our website, AccuWeather.com, where you can also see AccuWeather Now. That's our streaming feed of our AccuWeather Network presentation and other information as well, or those great radio stations that you catch me on every morning here on AccuWeather. We appreciate your support. We'll see you next week, another episode, Episode 8 on the way next week of Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. Be sure to subscribe to, rate, and review Everything Under the Sun on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And of course, if you have an idea for a future podcast, just email us at accuweather.podcast@accuweather.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.